This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In his 2010 book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies, our guest today, former Shell Oil President John Hofmeister, gave his insider's take on that question, blaming the industry itself, but also a political system that he says consistently fails to adopt what he calls a realistic, future-oriented energy policy. Hofmeister retired from Shell 5 years ago to found a new organization called Citizens for Affordable Energy. The group bills itself as a public policy education firm, promoting pragmatic, affordable energy solutions, environmental protections, and quality of life. As its chief executive, Hofmeister travels the country talking about these issues. He's in New Hampshire today to speak at St. Anselm College's Institute of Politics tonight at 7 o'clock. Hofmeister's main point is this, that private energy investment is all the stimulus our economy needs. However, we won't get there, he says, unless government gets mostly, but not completely, out of the way. Hofmeister envisions policy being set by one new entity he calls the Federal Energy Resources Board, a high-level independent government agency akin to the Federal Reserve. Today in The Exchange, Rethinking Energy with John Hofmeister. We'll hear his ideas on energy policy, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or put a comment on our Facebook page. And John Hofmeister, it's been a couple years. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. It's delightful to be here.
Well, the last time we talked a couple years ago, you said that energy policy has been hijacked by what you called the reckless right and the ludicrous left. You presented yourself as offering a sort of third way between these two. So what's your perfect balance, John, looking out 10 years between fossil fuels and other types of non-carbon-based fuels?
I actually think we have to look out longer than 10 years. I think we need a 50-year time horizon, but the first 10 years are what we call short-term. So let's talk about short-term over the next 10 years. We can come back and deal with middle-term and longer-term perhaps later. But within the short-term, the most important issue that we face as a society is the crippling of our economy by OPEC cartel pricing of transportation fuel through the crude oil price. This is the fifth January, February in a row that Americans have been watching pain at the pump stories on all the major media. And when you see the gasoline price go up 50 to 70 cents in a period of 4 to 6 weeks, people say, what's going on here? Who's doing this to me? Is this the oil companies out for more profits? Is there some shortage that I don't know about? No, it's cartel oil price pricing, which is a control by the OPEC sovereign states over how much crude oil they are going to produce for the world, which really sets the price of crude oil. So in the October-November timeframe, crude oil was in the low 80s. Now suddenly, it's hit $97 in late January, early February. How can you go up $15? What's changed? Well, one thing that's changed that many people aren't aware of, Saudi Arabia cut back production by 900,000 barrels a day in December. They held that lower production rate in January. Why did they do that? It's my view, others may not share it, that Saudi Arabia didn't like the $82 oil price, because the king of Saudi Arabia committed to a certain level of social spending during the Arab Spring, which $82 a barrel won't pay for.
To tamp down unrest that he sees happening in other countries around him.
And so in the short term, we Americans are paying the social bill for Saudi Arabia based upon the crude oil price. And if we don't do something domestically in the next 10 years to get off the OPEC cartel, then shame on us, is my view. Shame on us. We have the natural resources in this country. We have the technology. We have the financial capital, all private, no public money. And we have the people to dramatically increase domestic oil and natural gas production. But it's not just oil. We have to move beyond oil because oil is getting ever more expensive, ever harder to produce and ever less efficient in the way we produce oil because of the energy in for the energy out relationship.
It takes a lot more to get it out of tar sands than it does just to drill in the ground.
That's right. And so why not natural gas for a transportation fuel? We can use it in its gaseous form. We can turn natural gas into liquid. You can make diesel from natural gas. You can make gasoline from natural gas. You can make methanol from natural gas. And we can adjust our cars, new fleet cars, particularly where it's very inexpensive to produce a natural gas compatible engine, let's say methanol. It's a $100 kit for a brand new car. It would be more expensive if you're using, for example, liquefied natural gas in a truck or gas to liquids in a truck. It'd be several thousand dollars for a truck. But we have all this natural gas benefiting people who use electricity because power production prices have really been helped by the natural gas plenty that we have. But let's start looking at it as a transportation fuel. Not start. Let's do it. We know how to do it. Let's do it. And we get off of the OPEC effect.
So two big avenues of questioning, just based on what you said, John. One is the idea of domestic energy and why you think that's important. And I'll get to that. But here's another question. Some people on the environmental side would say it's good that gas prices are high. It forces people to cut back. It forces people to carpool or take public transit or whatever. It forces policymakers to, you know, start to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy, which, you know, most people would say is dirty, it's harming our planet, and so forth. So is there an environmental upside to these high gas prices?
Well, there is a sanctimonious view. And I know that that is a harsh word in some circles, a sanctimonious view that the wealthy of this country should tell everybody how to live. If you're a median income family, which is $50,000 a year in the United States of America or less, which is more than half the nation, I don't think you appreciate the sanctimony of somebody telling you that you should pay a higher gasoline price affecting your lifestyle and your disposable income because you're better off. I have a real problem with that. When, in fact, the supply-demand relationship is such that we have built an economy and a lifestyle on affordable fuel. So for a small slice of society to proclaim higher prices to wean us off fuel— The way we get off of gasoline, and I write in my book, we have to get rid of the internal combustion engine. So none of your listeners should think I'm here, you know, peddling for the oil companies. I want to see the end of the internal combustion engine. But, you know, if we started today, it would take 30 years. So what's the gas price over that 30-year period? And what about our low-income fellow citizens who have every bit of right to affordable energy that wealthier people have? And I worry about this becoming a nation of energy haves and have-nots because of some group that says, oh, let's charge more for gas. Then people say, well, let's rebate the price of gas. Let's put a carbon tax and rebate the carbon tax. That's fine, but shouldn't a carbon tax be used to eliminate carbon?
So what's the incentive to move to that fossil fuel future if not by the pain of higher prices?
In the first instance, leadership of good technical ideas, such as natural gas for transportation. Second, let's pursue lower mileage vehicles, more efficient vehicles, which we are, more battery vehicles. But batteries aren't the quick fix that people might think. There's a long journey for battery-based cars. There's a long journey for hydrogen fuel cell-based cars. But let's get on with the journey.
This is the political leadership that you say is lacking.
Exactly. We had the Bush administration, and I'm no fan of the George W. Bush administration, but the Bush administration, to its credit, put hydrogen fuel cells as a priority, along with biofuels, and they didn't resist batteries. The Obama administration came along and stopped the hydrogen fuel cell program in its tracks by zeroing out the budget until Congress reinstated it back in 2009. That set us back to where now Japan and Germany are leading the auto transition in hydrogen fuel cell technology, and the U.S. is trailing because we lost the incentive when we went a different direction. For transparency purposes, I'm the chairman of the Department of Energy's Hydrogen Technology and Fuel Cell Advisory Committee, so naturally I would have a point of view on this because it's the work I've been doing. And I chose not to resign in protest when the Obama administration cut back on hydrogen fuel cells, to see it through, to stay the course, because I believe that this, the alternative to internal combustion engines, has to be developed. And over the next 10 years, that's the primary development stage. Then in the medium term, we start transitioning to the new fleet of battery and hydrogen fuel cell, and we use less oil. So
here's a question for you, John, though. And we started off talking about your idea that you feel like private investment in energy, government largely getting out of the way, and we'll hear your ideas on that in a minute, that that's the way to go. And yet you just expressed disappointment that the government is no longer funding a program to support hydrogen fuel cells. And yet, you know, that's an instance of the government not getting in the way, out of the way. So is there a paradox there?
Let me explain government in the way. I'm not asking the government to back off regulations. We need regulations to keep the playing field level. We have every bit as much responsibility to protect our environment and the health and safety of our people across the nation as we do to provide them with affordable energy. So let's have tough regulations. Let's stick with what we decide to do and hold everybody accountable and not make it easy, so that people who are prone to cut corners and to go for the cheapest solution in energy production, put them out of business. The companies that are responsible, the companies that see stewardship of the environment as part of their business model along with the production of energy, those are the people that can work well in a regulatory and a regulated environment. So let's continue that path. Where government needs to perhaps, it's not as much get out of the way as lead the way forward with enabling programs, without politicizing those enabling programs, where because we had a Republican administration, a Democratic administration has to blow up the Republican approach. Remember, we're talking 10 years here, then we're talking another 40. We'll have somewhere between, who knows, 4 to 6 presidents in that period of time. If we change directions every 2 years or 4 years, we're only going to set ourselves backward, not forward.
Yeah, this is what you talk about. Energy time versus political time. One looks more long-term, one looks short-term. A lot more to follow up on, John, after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more with Shell Oil's former president coming up on The Exchange. 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, what across-the-board cuts could mean for America. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. New Hampshire weather today becoming partly sunny across the state. Highs from 35 to 40 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from, you are members, and from Granite State Credit Union, providers of local residential and commercial mortgage and equity products with locations statewide. Equal housing lender, gscu.org. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, developing new sustainable models of healthcare, improving lives for generations to come. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with John Hoffmeister, founder and CEO of the group Citizens for Affordable Energy, former Shell Oil president. He's also a visiting scholar at the Global Institute of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Mr. Hoffmeister is in New Hampshire today to speak at St. Anselm College, and we've got a link on our website if you want more information on that event at 7 o'clock tonight. You can join us now with your calls, questions, emails, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Now that you've heard a little bit about Mr. Hoffmeister's views on what it would take to bring in a balanced energy policy, what it'll mean to get there, what do you think? Do you agree or disagree? 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go to some of our emails first, if we could, John. And this is from Lynn in Sanbornton. She says, I hope you will balance out by giving prime time to a fossil fuel energy mouthpiece today to giving prime time to someone without a vested interest in fossil fuels, their ongoing development and use. Lynn, I just want to say I'm really glad you emailed. Last week, we spent an hour with Tom Butler, head of the Post Carbon Institute, talking about his book on energy, where he calls for capping the grid, no more kilowatt growth, replacing every kilowatt of fossil fuels with a renewable kilowatt. So we did cover that ground last week, and I'm glad you emailed Lynn and maybe you didn't catch the show. What do you think, though, John, about this? She's calling you a fossil fuels energy mouthpiece. And certainly when someone hears that you're the former president of Shell Oil, they might think that.
Well, first, I would say that every American who practices personal mobility in this country is invested in fossil fuels because it has a monopoly on their transportation. Whether they fly, whether they drive, unless they totally exist on public transportation, and even then, it's a fossil fuel-based public transportation system. Secondly, Citizens for Affordable Energy, my foundation, in its charter, is prohibited by its board of directors from taking any financial contributions from any energy company.
From wind, gas,
any energy,
oil, whatever.
We do not take energy from producers because our mission is affordable energy. And affordable energy is what frees the American disposable income for discretionary purchases across the economy. So we're not advocating fuel to sell more oil. We're advocating affordable fuel for the good of the economy generally. And when OPEC is setting our prices for us, then we're not exactly free to spend money on other things at our discretion. I do have an association with the oil companies, and I'm proud of the technology. I'm proud of the people who work in that industry, who take great risk to bring Americans the natural gas, the oil.
But 11 almost, people died in that BP spill, as we're being reminded this morning with the trial going forward.
I used to say to my wife at night, because our apartment in Houston looks out over the Gulf of Mexico and way off in the distance. We can't see it. We have over 1,000 people out there tonight. I hope they'll all be safe because it is a risky business. And yes, they're highly paid to take that risk, but it is risky nonetheless. And I consider them, in a sense, American heroes because they keep us fueled throughout the day, month, and weeks. And so I have the disagreement with the energy companies and did when I was there. So my testimony is public record in Congress talking about the future of energy and the need for moving on to other alternatives, alternative fuels, and to move away from the internal combustion engine, which is published in my book. And so I respect many of the opinions coming from the oil business, but I think that there's more nuance here and there's more complication to deal with as we look at the next 50 years.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Lynn, thanks again for that one. Here's another one from Ken. John, it says, at no time has it ever been the case that the government has had to get out of the way for innovation. Innovation has always relied on government help. The Transcontinental Railroad, interstate highway system, power infrastructure, etc., have relied on government action. The Keystone Pipeline and New England's Northern Pass are going to rely on eminent domain and other policies. Ken concludes by saying, government inaction is what gives us the banking crisis, Industrial Revolution era exploitation, the near constant food contamination crises, and so on. So there's a call from our emailer, Ken, for government involvement in the energy industry. We were starting to go there before the break. What exactly do you mean by that?
I'm looking for the leadership of ideas and then the practical methods that enable that to go forward. I'm not talking about elimination of regulation because we need that to protect the environment. But here's an example that I'm very proud of. The Department of Energy in the 1970s invested money to learn the puts and takes of fracking wells. The availability of natural gas today, 35, 40 years on, is thanks to the leadership of the Department of Energy at the time when they invested taxpayer money to safely fracture the earth to produce natural gas from shale and oil. And so that kind of research and development is now paying off 40 years later. I'm a big fan of biofuels research, where government, the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, spends taxpayer money to develop advanced biofuels. I'm a big fan of government getting involved in safety and study of how to have safer operations in energy. A big fan of the government's role in nuclear power to protect us. But there's so much more that could be done from a leadership standpoint, working with industry. Industry has most of the technology, but the government has R&D money. That's where I think its proper role is. And so the R&D is fantastic, and we should have more of it. But I don't think government should put money into helping energy companies operate. So in other words, they should not pay to build battery factories. They should not pay to build solar factories. They should not pay to put people on drilling rigs. That's for private industry to do, in my opinion.
Pay for the innovation, the research, the inevitable mistakes that will happen.
That's right. Because industry doesn't exist to do all of its own R&D for society. It does R&D for itself.
Sure.
Very narrowly focused. Society's R&D is a proper role of government.
When does government then need to get out of the way, in your opinion, John? Again, you've written how political dysfunction and government interference at all levels has stymied the adoption of a rational, forward-looking energy policy. So what are you talking about, if not environmental regulation, if not R&D investment in solar, wind, fracking, whatever?
When it comes to energy infrastructure, where we've been building infrastructure for 100 years plus in this country, I'm not sure that your listeners know how much infrastructure permitting is required between local government, state government, and federal government.
You're talking about power lines, basically, getting it from the plant to
or
the home?
Building a power plant, building a refinery, building storage tanks, building pipelines. The whole range of infrastructure is an enormous undertaking. During my tenure, one of Shell's joint ventures added onto a refinery, an existing refinery that had been in business for some 80, 90 years. It took 3 years and 500 permits to be able to build that extension of that refinery. 3 years before we could turn a shovel of dirt. That, to me, is getting in the way. When a company's been in the refinery business for decades and decades and they know how to do the construction and they know what needs to be done, I'm not troubled by a permit or 500 permits, but it's the incredible wasted time where a permit sits at the bottom of a pile on a bureaucrat's desk for which there is no incentive to move that permit forward. Meanwhile, Americans are suffering from high-priced oil. This refinery expansion will increase the availability of product. In the 2008, 9, 10 timeframe is when this delay took place. And I think that's getting in the way. Layers and layers of government bureaucracy at multiple levels where the redundancy of effort is just enormous, which consumers are paying for in the end. And so that is duplicative work that I think is just stymieing. And it's not just the oil and gas industry. You can take almost any industry from the medical to the auto manufacturing, you name it. The government bureaucracy Americans don't realize is taking place. They're paying their tax dollars to pay for all of this bureaucracy that I think is redundant and unnecessary.
I've got a bunch more questions for you on that, John, including a salient local example. But I also want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. The number here on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. We're talking energy policy today with John Hoffmeister, founder and CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy, about the right balance of energies in this country and how he says politics often gets in the way of a rational energy strategy. Once again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Victor's calling first from Portsmouth. Hi, Victor. You're on the air. Go ahead. And Victor doesn't seem to be there. Victor, I hope you call back. 1-800-892-6477 again is the number. How about Bill in Contoocook? Bill, go ahead.
Yeah. Good morning.
Thanks for being with us, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wonder, I have a fairly late model car. Is there a way to convert that to run on a compressed natural gas or liquid propane?
You know, actually, that's a good question. As we talk about the whole fleet of American cars being switched to cleaner sources, a lot of people say, look, I can't afford a new car right now, but can I make the switch?
There are different conversion options that people could follow. Compressed natural gas, for example, would require the loss of the back of the car for additional storage of product. So compressed natural gas takes up a lot of room. That's why they talk about compressed natural gas for trucking. The actual conversion itself would probably be a four-digit number, so over $1,000, versus a new car where the kit that's built into the car, but not for compressed natural gas, but for methanol, let's say, made from natural gas, would be around $100. I'm not advocating conversion because the car wasn't designed originally with all the engineering specs for conversion. You can do it. There are body shop mechanics who will do it for you. But I just believe there's risk to the consumer in that regard. If you would try to use more ethanol or methanol in a car that's not flex fuel, then you know to add the flex fuel components once it's been engineered for something else, again, the risk is high, the cost is high. I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Yeah, a little tricky. All right. Thank you for the call, Bill. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Stan in Nashua who says, "Thank you, Mr. Hoffmeister, for your efforts to educate the world on options for our global energy future. Please ask Mr. Hoffmeister how he feels about fracking, especially concerning the disposal of fracking chemicals." And as you well know, John, there are a lot of people who, you know, say, yeah, it's great we're getting all this natural gas, but we're not too happy about fracking to pull out that natural gas. Concerns about water quality, even earthquakes.
Fracking needs three or four basic elements for it to be successful and to be safe. First, the regulatory regime has got to be tough to weed out those who would not follow it, number one. Number two, the engineering design of the well and the execution of that design has got to be done according to specifications. Third, the recovery of the wastewater along with all the elements that are underground has to be managed in a closed system. You simply cannot allow leaks or disposal of the wastewater that is untreated and it is not part of a closed system where you are managing whatever's in that wastewater. And fourth, the community has to have a transparent view into what is actually happening so they feel confident that whether it's their water table systems, their water table, their water systems, the disposal, all of that is being handled according to regulations. Under those conditions, I think hydraulic fracturing, with the economic value created from the production of the natural gas liquids or oil, is beneficial to a community and to a society.
Here's a question, though. You talked about wastewater. Is it a waste of water to do fracking? I've read that tremendous amounts of water need to be used for this process, and some say, look, that's drinking water we could be using.
Well, it's water that's well below drinking water table at the drinking water level. So a lot of the water that comes from this far down in the earth is briny, and so it's salty. It's got all kinds of other earth elements in it. It would have to be seriously treated to be potable or drinkable. And so it is. There's a lot of water down there, but you're 1,000, 1,500, up to 5,000 feet below the earth. Nobody has a well at 5,000 feet.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you have to use a lot of water to even get in there, to sort of blast the rock apart?
In the technology that has been developed in the last, say, 20, 30 years, it was water-based. The industry is working as hard as can be on waterless fracking, because it recognizes that the increased amount of water for additional fracking is going to challenge some parts of the country. But here's an interesting statistic. The amount of water used in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale for fracking is a small percentage compared to the water used on golf courses in Pennsylvania. But it's still water being used. So I'm not trying to make the case that it's not a problem, but it is something that is the industry's aware of it. They're working on, the kind of fracking that can be done with air. Use air rather than water, for example. Use rocket fuel or some other substance to frack underground. The fracking is critical there, if you're going to get molecules out of shale formations.
All right. Well, Stan, thanks for the email. And our number again, 1-800-892-6477. Len is calling in from Springfield. Hi, Len. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. You want to convert all of our vehicles to natural gas. Natural gas is still a hydrocarbon, and when you burn hydrocarbons, you create CO2, oxides of nitrogen. Is that correct?
So why even go that step, are you saying,
Len?
Exactly.
Why waste our time with that? Why don't we wean ourselves off all hydrocarbons? And I'll take my answers off the air.
Len, thanks for the point. Go ahead, John.
Well, the objective is to get rid of the internal combustion engine totally. for personal transportation.
So ultimately we're on battery-powered cars, and hopefully the electricity for those batteries comes from wind, solar, whatever.
Electrify the fleet. That's the end game. So no question in my mind about the end game for transportation. There is going to be an impending shortage of crude oil for the world, which is going to make gasoline, diesel unaffordable for most people, particularly median income and below. If we don't find an alternative fuel soon and develop the infrastructure to use it, we're simply going to price ourselves out of gasoline or diesel from crude oil because the price is going to be too high and it's just not going to enable affordable transportation. And why do I say that? Well, when you look at the basins around the world and the challenges of producing crude oil, whether it's the geopolitics in the Middle East and the uncertainties of the volatility there, number one. Number two, big new openings like the Arctic Circle, East Africa, Brazil, pre-salt. The technology, the safety, the risks, the security, the infrastructure, all of that is a 2030s, 2040s time frame, not 20-teens. So in the 20-teens, we're asking existing reservoirs to produce not just the 88 million barrels a day that we consume in the world today, but another 5, 10 million barrels a day to satisfy China's needs, India's needs, and others' needs. And my fear is there's just not enough. So at any price, we could be standing in gas lines if we only depend upon crude oil and its products. Natural gas is an additive while we transition to an electrified fleet.
So that's your answer to why not just jump straight from, you know, gas today to the battery-powered future that you see. You're saying we can't do it that quickly? Is that what you mean? I'm not
That's
really
right.
sure what you mean.
People, when they buy a car, want the economic value of that car to be realized before they buy another car. So the average length of time that a car is in the American fleet is 15 to 20 years. Not that it's going to have the same owner during that same time period, but it's going to have multiple owners probably. But the car is going to be an economic valuable item for somebody in that time period. So you've got to have whatever that car runs as fuel during that period of time. It's not like a flipping a switch and suddenly we go just to electrification. Tesla has a 5-month wait for their battery cars today. If we couldn't find alternatives, people would be carless.
All right. Well, Len, I appreciate the point. Thank you for calling in. More of your calls and emails after a very short break. So keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Company C, creating a lifestyle of colorful living with brightly colored area rugs, bedding, furniture, and home accents. Retail store in Concord and online at companyc.com. And ENH Power, offering New Hampshire residents coal-free and pure green electricity. More information online at enhpower.com. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR counts on listener support to keep you informed about important issues and events in New Hampshire and around the world. We always try to keep fundraising to a minimum, and when you give online before the drive, you can help us out with that. Plus, you'll be automatically entered to win all of our drawing prizes throughout the March Fund Drive. And when you make your gift before 6 p.m. on February 28th, you could win an Apple iPad. Make your gift at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, John Hoffmeister is with us. He's founder and CEO of the group Citizens for Affordable Energy. He's the former Shell Oil president. He's also a visiting scholar at the Global Institute of Sustainability at Arizona State University. He's in New Hampshire this weekend to speak at St. Anselm College's Institute of Politics tonight at 7 o'clock. We've got a link on our website if you want more information on that event. Right now, you can join us with your calls and questions, 1-800-892-64. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And John, I want to go back to our listeners in just a minute, but I want to also return with you briefly to your frustration with the time and layers of government involvement in getting permits approved for energy infrastructure. And you said, you know, we're all paying for that. We could move to this 21st century energy economy if there weren't so much bureaucratic delay. Here's a local example, though, John, that I want to ask you about. Here in New Hampshire, there's been very strong opposition to a hydropower project proposal that many folks, especially in our North Country, feel will ruin their landscape, by extension, their tourist economy. So some of those folks would say these permit delays and these many layers of permitting are great because they allow we the people to have a voice. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I certainly believe that there is a role for public involvement in infrastructure decision making. This can't just be an industry-led or a government-led process because we the people do have a point of view. Once that point of view is expressed, however, decisions have to be made. And not everyone is going to come out on the right side of a decision because infrastructure is for the public good broadly. In the same way we built an interstate highway system, if people recall back in the 60s, we had riots. We had sit-ins on bulldozers.
People didn't want those highways coming through their backyards.
Particularly through urban areas, when we would build an interstate highway through an urban area and dislocate thousands of people. So there is a need for the public input, but there is also a time when the public good overrides the interests of the few.
Wow.
It's
so who
always,
makes those decisions?
Well, that's the role of government, taking into account all the views of all the respective parties where everyone has had their chance to have a say. We now see the court system being used for further delays, which has happened for many, many decades. It's nothing new. But when the court system gets involved, there are laws that are written in such a way as to still make progress. And so what we have to understand is the total social economic cost of what it is that we do when we protest. Because the fact of the matter is we need the infrastructure to keep the lights on, to keep people's homes warm and safe. And society really depends upon that infrastructure. So for some people, it's tough. I understand it's tough, but they live in a free society where everyone needs to benefit for the common good, and that's the trade-off we make in a free society.
Well, one person's definition of progress is another person's devastation. You know, this coal plant is going to harm health and foul the local waters. Or again, this hydropower project, the fear is that it will ruin our views, our property values. So it's really tricky to decide who gets to decide how to balance out those interests.
It's a dilemma. It's a conundrum. It's a difficult aspect of life. And yes, I recognize people are negatively impacted. But as a society, aren't we better off to live the lifestyle that we know in this country? The alternative is simply unacceptable. Not to have the infrastructure that keeps the lights on.
Well, you had an idea, and I remember we talked about this a couple of years ago, of getting rid of a lot of these layers of permitting and government involvement and leaving it up to one sort of quasi-independent agency, kind of like the Federal Reserve, where it's part of government, but it has a lot of independence. Tell us about that idea and how it would work for energy, John.
With the current governance model that we have, we've had the highest prices of gasoline in the history of the country over these last 5 years. Congress has not passed a single bill in the last two Congresses to do anything about it. The president has said he has an all-in, all-the-above energy strategy. And yet, federal drilling is down by 50%. The five-year plan for offshore future drilling to 2017 is just a rehash of old plans, old drilling programs, old lease programs. No new basins have been opened up on federal offshore in this five-year plan. And so what I see is a governance of inability to decide how to move forward. It's not just inability to decide on energy. We have other inabilities to decide, whether it's budgets or whether it's many other issues that we face as a nation. So when it comes to energy, we have 13 cabinet-level agencies in the federal government, executive branch, 26 congressional committees and subcommittees in the legislative branch, 800 federal judges can decide a case. Then we have 50 state governors, 50 state legislatures, 50 state court systems. And then we have thousands and thousands of municipalities and counties and townships that can also govern energy. My point is that if we're going to have this much governance, we need a leadership of the large governance. We had a monetary system in the 19th century that collapsed twice in the early 20th century. the Congress created the independent agency called the Federal Reserve under the Federal Reserve Act. Since 1913, when it came into effect, while not perfect, because we had the Depression and we had the 2008 meltdown, while not perfect, it has been an institution that has operated outside of politics for the most part, where presidents don't decide the interest rate of the country, Congress doesn't decide the interest rate or the money supply, for good reason, because they're driven by two-year political concerns, and the monetary system has to support the entire economy and the American people. Well, I think the energy system of the future is for the American people. It's for the American economy. It's not for politicians. And politicians have been whipsawing Americans at the price level based upon their unwillingness or inability to make choices for the long-term development of our energy system. So for the 21st century, we cannot just prolong the life of the 20th century system. It's too old. It's too dirty. It's too inefficient when we have new technologies for the 21st century, but zero presidential leadership, zero congressional leadership, because frankly, they're not in office long enough to make a material difference.
They're in that short time frame that you talked
about
earlier.
Or they're whipped by politics of the day.
Yeah.
And so this independent agency could set the 10-year, 25-year, 50-year roadmaps that we need and be the super governance of energy that I think we require.
The Federal Energy Resources Board, again, using the analogy of the Federal Reserve. And boy, I could ask you a million questions about this, John, but here's just one, and then we'll go back to our listeners. How could people trust that this board could truly balance the needs of the individual, again, that person who doesn't want the coal, you know, in their backyard or the hydropower project in the backyard, but also the country at large? It seems like from day one, this agency would be ripe for criticism that, you know, it was too biased for alternatives or too biased towards fossil fuels or too biased towards one region of the country over the other.
The risk is there. No question about it. But in the same way people protest the interest rates set by the Federal Reserve, or they protest the money supply too tight, too loose, and people complain all the time, there is room to complain. But I think when it comes to the energy board that I'm referring to, they would set the targets for the supply side, what kind of fuel and how much of it in our economy. So whether it's wind, solar, biofuels, nuclear, hydropower, oil, coal, natural gas, what have you, geothermal, hydrogen, they would determine over an extended period of time how much from what source. Then they would identify those efficiencies, which can mean using less energy, and build that into the system. And third, make sure the environment, land, water, and air is getting better, not worse. And it's not about staying the same. It's about getting better, not worse. And fourth, the infrastructure that we need. The infrastructure is what gets in people's faces and gets up against their property line. That's always going to be controversial. But, you know, we have a country where pipelines and transmission lines are everywhere. Why don't we have pathways? Why don't we establish national pathways for pipelines?
Kind of federal highways.
National pathways. Exactly. Bunch them all together, less people would be impacted. You can look at other countries. They have pathways for infrastructure, but we've got them everywhere.
We haven't done it in a concerted, organized way. I want to share you with our listeners again, John, and go to Nicole, waiting in Lebanon. Hi, Nicole, go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, and thanks for this very provocative conversation. And I realize we have to look at transition to what between what's practical now, what's affordable, what's doable now, and in the future. But I've been a little bit disturbed, more than a little disturbed, to not hear any acknowledgement of the impending and with us now crisis of climate change and the roles that continued dependence on hydrocarbons will play. I know there was allusion to this earlier in the program, and that will not discriminate among income levels. I kind of objected to the sanctimony charge earlier. I can't afford gas the way it is now either, but I understand that I can't rely on it forever. So what I'm interested in is constructive thoughts on what the future really holds. Does your guest really see fossil fuels as having a sustainable role in the 21st century energy scheme?
That is a great question, Nicole. Thank you very much for calling in. Go ahead, John.
I think we will see the end of fossil fuels when we finally have a plan that has a 50-year time horizon. Because anything less than a 50-year time horizon is unlikely to move quickly enough to eliminate fossil fuels. And with respect to the caller, based upon the infrastructure we have, and the way we live our lives currently, we will have a political system that will perpetuate fossil fuels for as long as I can see in the future without a longer-term plan. Because when we get into the short-term dynamics of so-called pain at the pump, and we get into the short-term issues of shortages, gas lines, politicians are passive reactive by definition. And so they will passively react to the pain that people are feeling at the pump and prolong the agony of the current system. And it's time to move on. And people will choose electrification not because it necessarily costs less, but because they prefer it. It's like people flocking to smartphones. American consumers love technological improvement. And that's why I've been at the hydrogen fuel cell work for almost a decade now, but have been handicapped by government flip-flopping, basically.
The policy keeps changing.
And so
every
if you don't have
years.
A 50-year plan, you're going to get government flip-flopping based on election cycle, based on which party wins this cycle, and we can't afford that flip-flopping. And so absent a body that has governance authority for an extended period of time, like what I'm talking about, the caller's aspirations to move more rapidly will actually go backwards. They'll be more and more frustrated because I don't think the political system can respond. We had a president in 2009 who said, this is the day that the seas stop rising and the earth begins cooling. Then we had the Waxman-Markey bill.
Talking about Obama. In his first days in office.
We had the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill, which the Republicans called cap-and-tax. It passed in the House by just a few votes, I think 8 votes, which means 4 people could have changed their vote and it wouldn't have passed. And the Senate wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And the president went silent on climate change.
Well, we were talking about that before the hour. So, Nicole, I'm glad you called. Just before the program started, John, you and I were talking about you met with a group of environmentalists in San Francisco just a week ago, and you heard their thoughts on President Obama's sort of renewed call to combat climate change.
They're very excited by that. But they're also doubting whether he's serious because his own words in the State of the Union address said he would ask his cabinet executives for recommendations. Where's the leadership that we should be looking for from the nation's chief executive? Where's the programmatic planning that would actually address the caller's concern? There is none. And so I'm very frustrated with the political process. I'm very sympathetic with the need to move beyond fossil fuels. That's why I say we should eliminate the internal combustion engine. That, to me, is the largest symbol of the seriousness of this nation to get real about its fossil fuel habits. But that's going to be long and slow, as I said. But when you don't have leaders willing to stand up and say, this is what I believe in, and during the campaign of 2012, nothing on climate change.
No one said a word, barely.
And so that's not good enough. That's my point to New Hampshire listeners. That's not good enough. And the reason I'm advocating a change in governance, these people have failed us. 8 presidents in a row, from Nixon to Obama, have promised energy independence of one sort or another. And here we are at the mercy of OPEC pricing in January, February 2013. I'm irritated. I think the whole country should be irritated because we're paying these people to lead. And what do we get? Not leadership, that's for sure.
Nicole, thank you for calling in. And here's an email from Deb in Hudson. No, excuse me. I think I'm going to go with Bruce, actually, who emailed in a little earlier. Sorry about that, Deb. Because it gets to what your point is about OPEC and energy independence. Bruce says, many people say we should drill for more energy independence. But then it's pointed out that all oil is traded on the global market. Are you going to change that system, Bruce asks? And Bruce, it's a question I had too. John, some people say this energy independence is a myth, that oil is traded on a global marketplace, like a big bathtub, basically, and it doesn't really matter where it comes from. You probably thought a lot about this as the former president of Shell Oil.
And it's true. Oil does go into the big bathtub and is traded globally. But my argument is there's not going to be enough oil because the basins, the big basins of the future are way out in the future. 10, 20, 30 years out because of the safety requirements and the risks associated, technical as well as environmental risks. They will be developed at some point, but they're not going to be here in the next 3, 4, 5 years when we need more oil, when China is putting 17 million new cars a year on the highways of China. And so I'm worried about the next 5 years, and do we have sufficient supplies for this country at affordable prices? So oil is not the solution, but alternative fuel is. Natural gas can be a competitive fuel that people would be very happy with in their vehicle if it's compressed natural gas or for trucks, and I'm primarily compressed natural gas for trucks because they have the space for the tankage.
Conversion's easier, yeah.
And for new cars, make it liquid. You can make gasoline from natural gas. You can make methanol from natural gas, both of which can work in a flex fuel engine. Well, natural gas gasoline can work in any car. But if you don't have the alternative fuel, then you don't break OPEC's back.
I see. So you're not talking so much about the bathtub of global oil. You're talking about moving off traditional oil completely.
I do think we can produce more oil, and therefore we should, because it could reduce imports. But also we need natural gas to be an alternative fuel to really come to grips with OPEC.
Well, and Bruce, thanks for that email. And boy, we could talk for a lot longer. John, good luck with your talk tonight, and thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
John Hofmeister, founder and CEO of the group Citizens for Affordable Energy, former Shell Oil president. He'll be speaking tonight at St. Anselm College's Institute of Politics. Got a link on our website for more information on that event if you'd like. John Hofmeister is also a visiting scholar at the Global Institute of Sustainability at Arizona State University. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, to raise or not to raise the minimum wage. President Obama has called for an increase in the federal minimum wage, and several New Hampshire lawmakers have proposed raising it in the state as well. Supporters say this could help lift many out of poverty, but opponents warn it could lead to a loss of jobs. We'll examine these arguments and how the economy might be affected. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.